Okay, so time for the next talk. This is Steve Harris from Southampton on LAD SPA plugins. Sorry?
It should work.
Okay, just. In this case, I can even say a few introductory words myself because I know just a tiny bit about LAD SPA. So for those in the audience who do not know about it yet, it has been developed by, once again, several guys from the LAD SPA mailing list, one of them being Richard Furse, who was the main implementer. It's a very simple API to, say, route audio streams through a filter, and this filter can do anything. It can be a distorter, we heard this yesterday, it can be a flanger, it can be a pitch shifter, and Steve has contributed to this development a lot by developing some 40, 50, maybe 60 plugins so far. I don't know the precise number. 80?
Yeah.
Okay. Is the mic on? Okay. like 80, okay. And even one of them is from me, which is just a simple mono to stereo splitter, but okay, forget about this. So this is more about the development of LAD SPA plugins and the famous Bode frequency shifter. Steve, here's your audience.
Okay. Right, what I'm going to talk about is I'm going to explain a little bit about how audio is represented in computers, and I'm going to walk through the planning process I did when I was developing the frequency shifter. And then I'll do some demonstrations of stages along the way, showing you how the stuff really works and kind of proving that it does what I say it does, because there's no reason why you should believe me. I'm aiming to show that DSP coding isn't really very difficult, and try and encourage people to develop plugins or any DSP software really under Linux. And I'll also explain how the Bode shifter works as I go through it, because quite a lot of people have asked me how it works, and it's kind of simple, but it needs a bit of explanation. Okay, audio is stored, or at least processed inside computers, as a pulse code modulated signal, which is a kind of representation of the way the pressure wave varies over time. When it's recorded through the analog system, but it's not. A lot of people think that it represents the kind of a graph of pressure over time, and it doesn't. It's a bit more complicated than that. Most of the time it doesn't matter, but there are a few situations where it does, which is why on here you can't really see on the projector, but I've drawn the data points as lines rather than a continuous curve, although I won't use it later on because it's kind of hard to read, but it's sometimes important to remember that it isn't actually a continuous curve, it's something slightly different. Okay, so because it's just a series of numbers, there are two basic operations you can do on it. You can delay it, which is really that simple. You just stick a bunch of zeros in front of it or whatever, and then start pulling data out of the stream. Just use a ring buffer. Or you can vary the amplitude over time. Cheers. this was the same wave as before, but it's had another sine wave superimposed over it to give it that kind of jagged edge. And that's just a multiplication operator. And that's fundamentally, that's the only two operations you can do on audio, so there isn't a lot to say. I mean, there's a lot of sort of complex math behind some of the extreme ends of it, but you can, you know, it's just, well, I'll demonstrate in a second. Some examples of classic effects. I mean, delays are obviously, you know, just delay. Filters are a whole series of delays with a gain multiplier on the end of each one that achieves the effect. The maths that you use to calculate the lengths of delays and the value of the multipliers is, it's not trivial, but there's software that will do it for you, so it's not hard. Phasers, just a whole bunch of filters stacked together. Flanges are a set of delays stacked together and then just multiply the results. Choruses are delays and filters, and you can kind of carry on like that forever. But the only one I'm going to talk about today is modulation, because that's just the multiplication. There's no delays involved at all. So it's dead simple to talk about, and I promised Frank I wasn't going to have any maths in this. So. Right. Although the audio is stored as a series of values over time, sometimes you have to think about it in another way. You have to think about it as being constructed from a series of sine waves. Any audio signal that's represented in this way can be constructed by adding together a set of sine waves of different frequencies. And if the wave is periodic, like the sine wave or the saw wave in this example, the frequencies and the amplitudes will be constant over time. So obviously a sine wave is just a single in the frequency space, sorry, it's represented as like a single value, which is the same amplitude as the amplitude of the sine wave. And where you have something periodic like a sawtooth, the frequency of the sawtooth, there's one value with the same amplitude as the saw, and then there's one at double the frequency at half, one at three times the frequency at one third, four times the frequency at quarter, and so on forever. Which is actually one of the problems we have in digital audio, that the fact that this thing doesn't ever go to zero is a problem, because the maximum frequency you can represent in the system is governed by the sampling rate, half the sampling rate, famous Nyquist theory. So if you try and store a saw wave that looks like this with a sort of sharp edges, then things that go off the end of the scale, as it were, and they end up being reflected backwards, back down this way. So in this example, there will be another peak here, slightly smaller, and here, and here, and here, and here, and here, and here, right back. And that's what's known as aliasing, which is a famous effect we all try and avoid. But you have to suffer, usually, because it's quite hard to remove. Okay. Ring modulation is simply just multiplying two signals that go into both half of the wave. If one of the waves only used the top half or the bottom half, then it would be amplitude modulation, but I'm not really going to talk about that. I'm just going to talk about ring modulation. So to create the output, you would multiply that value by that value, that value by that value, and so on. So the source code just looks like read a sample, multiply, write it out. Nothing much to it. Well, that's not quite true, because the aliasing problem, it's a little bit more complicated, but you just find someone else's ring modulator source code and use it, so it's easy. And the effect on the frequency space is that all the frequency components from this this wave here, which we'll call the carrier for the sake of argument, are shifted in each direction by the frequency of this one. So here, originally, this wave will be represented as a line between these two, and the result of the ring modulation is that you have two separate ones shifted up and down by this frequency. So in this case, it's simple. When the two waves have more harmonics, so if you two saws, it's complicated, but one complex and one simple wave is easy. That's the next slide. These resulting copies are called partials. Well, that's not quite true. Yeah. Right, to show that that's true, I've got a demo, which will hopefully work. And hopefully you'll be able to hear the result as well. This is the carrier wave here. It's just a sine wave. And there's no modulation happening. But if I... okay, if I... there's a modulator going, but it's not being modulated with a carrier wave. If I bring this up, you can hear the second tone appearing. And in the bottom is a representation of what's happening in the frequency domain. But this is just rendered from this information, so it's not actually being calculated from the resulting sound. I could have done that, but I didn't have enough time to finish the software. So you shouldn't believe the thing at the bottom. right. Let's just mute that for a second. Okay, so we can make a prediction. If this is true, what should happen if we have a carrier and a modulator of the same frequency? The resulting output should be a sine wave at 0 hertz, because you subtract the two frequencies, you get zero. And there should be, so that should be nothing. And there should be a sine wave at 2 times the frequency of the waves. So if I set that up, so we have two. What's going on there? Okay. Well, there's another sound coming in from somewhere. I don't. Okay, that's better. Okay, so we have a 100 hertz signal, and it's just on its own. And when I bring up the modulation, nothing happens. I'll try increasing the frequency. Okay, right, you can hear it now. Okay, so there's a 200 hertz sine wave and no modulation. And when I bring up the modulation, you can see and hear the frequency double. So this is the resulting waveform here. So that was attempting to prove to you that at least some of this stuff's true. Right, so what happens when you have a complex waveform and a sine wave is you end up with two copies of the complex waveform separated by the frequency of the sine wave. And as this talks about frequency shifting, that kind of seems important. The only problem is that these two sets of the input are mixed together. There's no way of separating them because they're generated by the result of this, and you get both of them or neither of them. And another point is it's not the same as pitch shifting, because if they were pitch shifted, the frequency between all of the gaps, so from zero to the first partial to the second partial to the third partial, would be constant. Whereas in this case, it's not, because the gap from zero to the first one is not the same as the gap from the first one to the second one in the two waves. So it has an alien texture to it, which I think is cool, and some other people like it as well. But it doesn't sound natural in any way, so it's not useful for pitch shifting over more than a few cents. Okay, so obviously if we're trying to achieve frequency shifting, what we want to do is we want to separate the two sets of partials into the ones that have been shifted up and the ones that have been shifted down. But there's something I didn't point out last time, and that is that there's a slight phase shift on the resulting output of the ring modulator, which I can demonstrate graphically. So you can see here, this is the modulated waveform. It starts at the lowest extent of the wave, and then it goes from there and rises up to the highest extent. So this is a cosine wave, and if I turn off the modulation, it goes back to a wave which starts at the midpoint and then rises to the top and then back down to the bottom and then back up. So that's a sine wave. And there's a 90 degree phase shift between a sine and a cosine wave, which is useful. So, and in fact, the other partial as well, that one's phase shifted by plus 90, the other one's phase shifted by minus 90, but I couldn't find a way of demonstrating that, so you just have to believe me. Right, I did promise I wasn't giving you maths, but I couldn't find any way of drawing this bit. But I promise you it's really simple, even though I have used stupid representation, but I hope the mathematicians can forgive me. So what I'm trying to say here is you've got a carrier ring modulated with a modulator, so it's just a multiply operator, and you end up with all the partials from the carrier minus all the partials in the modulator. That's the output partials at minus 90, and you end up with carrier plus the frequencies of the modulator at plus 90. So this is the next stage. So imagine for a minute you could phase shift the carrier by plus 90 degrees. When you ring modulate that with a modulator, what you end up with is the phase shift gets transferred through within the modulation. So you end up with the frequencies at the carrier minus the modulator with zero phase shift. That would normally be minus 90, but you've added 90 onto the resulting phases. And we end up with carrier plus the modulator at plus 180. But a 180 degree phase shift is really, really similar to inverting the wave. It's not exactly the same, but it's really similar. So effectively, that's the partials from the carrier minus the modulator minus the partials from the carrier plus the modulator. And if you phase shift the modulator by 90 degrees, which is very easy because we're using a sine wave, so you use a cosine wave instead of the sine wave for this ring mod, you end up with an equivalent situation, except you end up with minus C minus M and plus C plus M. And the trivial math you can do, if you if you add the two resulting ring modulations together, you end up with two times the amplitude of the carrier plus modulator partials, and minus two times the C minus M. So you've managed to separate out the two sets of partials. And there's also a special filter called a Hilbert transformer, which I'm not going to talk about, but you just run some software, it gives you a load of numbers, and you write that into a very simple bit of code, and it performs the operation, which will allow you to phase shift any arbitrary signal by plus 90 degrees. So, yeah, you've got what you want. You can phase shift the carrier, ring modulate it, modulate is easy to phase shift, and there you go. So, right, here it is all together. We've got a simple oscillator over here, which is going into a Hilbert transformer and into a ring modulator. And we've got a sine and cosine oscillator. The sine output's going into the first ring modulator. So this is a oscillator plus 90 into that one. And this is oscillator with no phase shift into this one. And we've got the zero phase shift here and the plus 90 here. And then the outputs are just mixed together. So adding them, and this output here is inverted. So we're subtracting it, and it's being added to this one, and then we send the resulting output to the output. So hopefully we should be able to hear the effect. Maybe. No, that's not the problem. No, they were both jack. Okay. Oh, it hangs the jack demon, right. Okay, well, you'll see slightly more of Jack than I intended. Yeah, that's running from the old Jack server there. Okay. Right. So that's just the output of this oscillator, which is a saw wave, and it's running at 1 kHz, which means that's an annoying whine. And this sine oscillator, so that's the carrier, and this is the modulator over here. So at the moment it's a very low frequency, like less than a hertz, so you can't really hear there's any phase shift. There's one down's coming out of one and up's coming out of the other, which hopefully they're far enough apart you can tell them apart audibly. So if I increase the frequency of this, you should hear them drift apart. It's still very low frequency. Okay, right, there you go. You can start to hear the phasing between the two frequencies. And then they're starting to actually be audible as separate tones. Right, and you can hear that because there's now a 100 kilohertz phase shift, and the original oscillator was a kilohertz. The bass tone of the oscillator is now down at almost zero, so you can hear the kind of really low frequencies from that. Okay, you can also hear some of the original You can also hear some of the original wave leaking through, and that is because large parts of this process aren't perfect. The Hilbert transformer doesn't give you exactly 90 degrees phase shift for all frequencies, so it's kind of a little bit fuzzy. It's not quite 90%. And the 180 degree thing I was talking about before being equivalent to an inversion, well, that's not that true. So, and also the ring modulator doesn't completely remove the original carrier signal, so it combines to make it a little bit dodgy. But basically, it does separate the frequencies and move them up and down. Okay, that was all I'd planned to talk about. It went through a lot quicker than I thought, but I can talk about anything else you want me to, or I can, yeah, anything really.
So, questions from the audience up there. Oh, this is Dave again. Let me do my usual 3-mile run.
I apologize for asking you this, Steve, but would you like to talk about MIDI and LADSPA?
MIDI and LADSPA, yeah, sure. Well, there isn't any. Next.
Would you like to tell us why?
Okay. Yeah, actually, I guess it would have made more sense if I started off by explaining some of the technical issues of LADSPA, but yeah. I wanted to kind of avoid that sort of stuff. LADSPA only knows about floating point values, and it knows about them in a very simple manner. So for every, this is the great thing about LADSPA. It makes it very easy to start programming because the interface is so simple. For every, you get handed blocks of samples, just like you do in Jack, so 64 samples, and for every block, all the parameters that you say you've got have a value, floating point value, and that's it. So MIDI doesn't really fit into that world because it's kind of event-based and it's kind of timing's very important. Whereas in the LADSPA world, there's no real concept of sub-block timing. So it makes writing the plugins really easy, and generally it's fine because you can do things like parameter smoothing. So when you have, if you have two blocks simultaneously and you have, say you've got, it's an amplifier, and you've got a parameter which is how much gain there is, you don't want to just suddenly jump the gain between the two blocks because you'll get an audible click. So, but you can just crossfade from the last amplitude value to the next one, and that will give you a sort of smoothish transition. It's tricks you can do to make it sound better. So generally it's fine, but for things like MIDI, it's not appropriate. That doesn't mean you can't build synths out of it, because you can still use techniques like the old control voltage synthesizers, where pitch is represented as a continuous signal, and you just feed that in at either control rate, so once per block, or audio rate, once per sample. And you can use that to do synthesis, but it involves using something like AMS here, but a hugely more complicated patch than this to generate a synthesizer, and not many people other than me and Mateus want to do that, so it's not useful for the general case. So, sorry?
Also not within a block.
Within a block.
Also, if you're using the control voltage input, it will not work within one processing block if you do a frequency modulation, for instance.
Well, the control voltages would normally be at audio rate. So you'd have one control value per sample.
Okay.
There are a few times you can get away without that, but yeah, for things like FM, you need one control value per sample, and you can't get around that. But in either case, it's not an ideal interface for most synthesizers. But I don't really think adding MIDI to LADSPA is appropriate. The S stands for simple, and MIDI's not.
So maybe just another question, or rather suggestion for a short description for people who want to get into writing LAD SPA plugins. We have this wonderful thing you developed, the XML stuff. So maybe for those who have not done this yet, maybe just drop a few words on how you develop plugins using the XML stuff.
Sure. Okay. Well, I can show you an example.
Use a large font, yeah.
Yeah. Okay, this is... I'm really lazy, and the actual source code for LADSPA plugins is pretty big. There's an awful lot of mechanistic rubbish, like creating ports, linking that to control structures. Cheers, Frank. Is that good? Yeah, okay. And the mechanistic stuff, I've changed the way I create I've changed the layout of the source code that I use quite frequently, and I realized I was going to want to do that early on. So I started off by wrapping the core bits of the actual DSP code in lumps of XML. And then I have a really, really nasty Perl script that I'll rewrite someday, which turns this XML description into the .c file. So this is the whole of the source code for an amplifier plugin. So it starts off the top. We've just got some metadata. That's just constants. And then you declare the plugin using the what's the pointer? Using the plugin element, give it a label, a unique identifier. That's something I'll talk about in a minute. You give it a name, and then you can provide a bunch of callbacks. Now, this one only has a run callback, which is the processing function, takes a number of samples. So and it's also got one parameter called gain, which is hinted to range from minus 70 to plus 70. So all I do for each block is calculate the gain coefficient, which is just using a macro on the, this is in decibels, so it just turns it into a linear value. And then just loop over all the samples. This is a macro which takes care of the difference between run and run adding, but basically it's equivalent to output pars equals input pars times coef, and that's it. And when I hit make, that builds a huge .c file and compiles it up, and you've got a plugin. And this makes it really easy. I mean, the Hilbert transformer and the sine and cosine oscillator didn't exist until last night, and I wrote them in about 10 minutes. It was easy. Because you just take one of these things, you know, cut and paste it out, add more code, and there it goes. This class thing is a way for me to automatically build RDF descriptions of plugins, which I won't bother explaining what that is because I've ranted about it on the mailing list for ages. But it's basically just a way of categorizing the plugins so that when you have a host like Jackrack, if I've got it installed on here. Yeah. When you want to select a plugin from the list, instead of just having a huge list of 150 or however many there are plugins, they're categorized. So that last one you saw would appear under generators because it was an oscillator. It's an amplifier. So amplitude, amplifiers, and this is the one you're looking at here. So it just makes it slightly easier to find the plugins rather than having to scroll through a list and trying to find them by name, especially when some of them have got stupid names, which is my fault, of course. Okay, I think that's all there is to say about generation. I can show you the .c file that's generated from that, but it's kind of nasty and you probably don't want to see it, so yeah.
Okay, and what I can add is that really starting to develop a tiny plugin just from a template XML file, even me, it took only about 20 minutes, which is a remarkable information. I didn't look at these XML files before. I just noticed that I want to have some tool that lets me input a single mono wave and output it on two ports in order to be able to connect this, I think, within Alza Modular or somehow. And I just looked at then one of these templates and put in what appeared naturally to me. And I think 50 minutes later, I mailed you, I need this plugin. And even before you could answer, I mailed back, I mailed again, sorry, I did it myself by now. So it's not too difficult, really. Okay, and also we had been starting together on a XML LUTSPA writing how-to, which we haven't finished yet, which we might try to restart after this conference and really release at some point, but it's not too difficult.
No, there really isn't very much to say. I mean, it does need sort of a little bit of documentation because there's lots of hints and stuff which come from LUTSPA, which you need to know how to express. But basically, it's just a case of filling in the blanks. There's a couple more callbacks as well. There's instantiate and activate, which are just sort of allocating data and stuff. But it's all really simple stuff.
And the really cool thing about all of these LED SPA plugins is that we have by now maybe, I guess, a dozen or more applications who use them. Like we saw Alza Modular using it. We saw Muse yesterday using it. And for all of these, it's the same. You write your plugin once, and then suddenly a couple of applications can use it. And this is really starting, like feeling a bit like VST instruments from the Steinberg world. Not quite really instruments, but only filters. But yeah, we're slowly getting there, and I think some of these plugins are quite remarkable in their quality. We heard the DJ Flanger yesterday. We have a quite good Freeverb. This is Jessa's Freeverb, which is already 2 years old now, but for being free, I think very high quality, and the number is growing each day. And for anyone who wants to go into programming something in the audio world, I think these plugins are a very good starting point because they are rather small and simple projects to go to.
Yeah.
Okay, any more questions from... Oh, yes, I see questions. Wonderful. The first one is nearby.
So if it's so simple, would it be possible to have a VST wrapper or audio unit for OS X?
Which way? I mean, there's already a system which makes VST plugins appear as LADSPA plugins. You mean the other way?
LADSPA is VST. So I want to, if there is some system where I can write portable plugins for Windows and macOS.
One of the reasons behind me starting to write them in this way was because I wanted eventually to port them to CSound. So I got a bunch of friends who are CSound users. I haven't actually got around to that yet. I kind of looked at some example CSound code and it was horrible, so I put it off. But I do intend to... Well, I'm definitely going to port them to OS X as LADSPA objects because there are some host, LADSPA hosts for OS X. And I'll probably look at creating them as audio units, but I really have no idea how hard that is yet. VST, I'm not particularly keen on, so I have no particular desire to support it. But someone could write a VST plugin which loads LADSPA plugins as a hosting thing. That wouldn't be a problem. There isn't any cross-platform plugin API yet, but there is one in development, which Paul spoke about yesterday, I think, called GMPI, which has been started by Ron Kapoor of Cakewalk. But that's still in the planning stage.
Okay, another question up here. Okay, right here.
So I would like to apologize that I'm not so deeply into the methodology of plugins as,
sure.
as you speak. So I ask bluntly. So as I understand it, that's some PCM in, PCM out plugin interface. So
yeah.
How about if I want to do like first codecs or other sources that I want to convert one like GUI output or stuff, but I want to transport it to other plugins again to have this interface on the plugin level, not on some GUI level.
Yeah, you can't do that in LADSPA.
Okay. Is there fine.
It's one of the... It's a design decision, which is, I think it's correct, because you can add features like, you know, variable rate or variable data types, but it complicates the API immensely, and the simplicity really is one of the strengths. I mean, there are some things it would be really nice to be able to do, like to be able to send pre-FFT blocks between plugins. You don't have to keep re-FFTing them, which is an expensive operation, but you can't, so that's fine. We just get around it.
Okay,
and you can always use something else, right?
Yeah, right. Okay. So that's my question. Thanks.
Okay. There is one question here from Paul Davis.
So, Steve, I thought I'd give you the opportunity to pontificate for a minute or five on and just listening to you responding to a couple of questions and talking and thinking about the number of similarities between LADSPA and Jack.
Yeah.
And I wonder if you want to speculate verbally rather than on the mailing list about some of the connections between just between the two of them in some sense, because a lot of what you're describing about generating LADSPA plugins seems to apply to generating Jack clients, for example.
Sure. Yeah, well, something I've intended to do quite often is to write something which takes this XML code and produces a Jack plugin, but the more I thought about it, the less need there seemed to be for it, because you've got plenty of things like Jack Rack, which are really efficient, and Echo Megapedal, and they do effectively the same thing. I'm sorry, I've completely forgotten who it was. Someone was talking to me yesterday about a system which allows you to build Jack systems from simple descriptions, like more simple than this. So that kind of thing's interesting, but I think at the C level, it's not really needed because the Jack API is really simple. It's far simpler than LADSPA in many ways. Actually, writing the code is a bit trickier because LADSPA doesn't let you do a lot. It makes it very hard to do a lot of dangerous things, whereas Jack makes it relatively easy. But the API of Jack is a lot simpler than the mechanistic level, you know, the .c level. Yeah.
Okay, more questions? That is Jörn. Yeah. I'm waiting for the day I fall down the stairs. Hopefully not today.
I got one question from Marek Peteraj. He wants to know, Steve, first of all, he wants to thank you for writing the LCR plugin for him. And then he wants to know, what's the state of Pressgang, your mastering project?
Alpha. Well, it uses the... that's another point we'll come to in a minute as well. It uses the compressor code from the... In fact, it uses LADSPA plugins to do the DSP processing. And it's... The compressors don't work, basically. And also, it's mostly a UI thing, and I'm a really bad UI programmer, so I keep kind of putting it off. So I think, realistically, I'm going to have to either get some help from someone that's a decent UI programmer, or I'll just have to keep muddling on through doing it when I can face doing it. Because it's a horrible SDL tangle at the moment, so it kind of needs stripping out. But most of the maths is done. It just needs some UI work and tying together, and I need to fix the compressors, which is what I wanted to come to. And that's that I don't get enough bug reports. I get, this SegFox tool hangs my machine or whatever, which is great, but people don't report audio quality bugs, even when I know they've heard them, because, when I meet people face-to-face, they are, so-and-so's great, but when I set it to, 3.2, it makes a weird whining noise. And usually it's simple stuff that I could fix really quickly, or I can at least, run it through a debugger and find out what the hell's going on, but... So I really would like people to report quality bugs more often. And really thick skin. They do not offend easily, so feel free to insult me.
Up the stairs again.
I think the central problem is, Steve, you've written so many plugins that we don't have time to actually test hardly any of them thoroughly at all. You plug it in and you fiddle with the faders, and say, wow, this is cool. Okay, I'll try another one.
Well, yeah, I think how bad it is for me, right? I mean, the thing is, though, between you all, I mean, you all, there's a couple of which nobody uses because they're terrible, but between most of you, you kind of use these things and you kind of live with the bugs, or you're not quite sure if they're a bug or not, so you don't bother reporting it. So this sort of distributed testing is really important. Something I've been planning for a while is to kind of try and get a group of people, non-programmers, just anyone who's got reasonably good hearing and can move a value up and down, to take 10 plugins each, and really thrash them, work out where they fail, where they start to sound funny, anything a little bit bizarre, so I can go through and fix it, because I really do not have time to go through and test them all individually. It's not practical for one person to do it, so, and it's incredibly tedious, obviously, so I'd like to get someone else to do it.
Okay, any more questions? Not? Okay, then, Steve, thank you very much.
Cheers.
We have a few minutes of break now. The next talk will be at 5 p.m. That's in 35 minutes. Will be François Deschel on various IRCAM software about JMEX and MSP. See you then. No? This is wrong? Oh. Okay, slight change, but we'll see. We'll work it out.